This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. When Jack Abramoff fell, he fell hard, pulling the lobbying profession down with him. At least one big Washington lobbying firm, Alexander Strategy Group, will shut its doors at the end of the month. And a new poll finds that 90% of Americans support banning lobbyists from giving any gifts to members of Congress, let alone vacations in Scotland or big expensive steak dinners. More than half of Americans would also sever the ties between lobbyists and political campaigns. They'd ban lobbyists from making campaign donations or even organizing fundraisers for political candidates. In response to the Abramoff scandal, the House and Senate both promise reforms, new laws, try to rein in lobbyists like Jack Abramoff. But is he representative of the profession? Well, most lobbyists would say no. Many question whether or not he really performed his services as a lobbyist. Today we're going to take a look at that field from its origins in Washington during the Victorian era to what lobbyists are supposed to do for their clients today. We'll talk with members of Congress or find out how members of Congress are lobbied and how those lobbyists are associated and those not associated with K Street in Washington. That's the address synonymous with high-powered lobbying, how those smaller firms can flex their muscles. You have questions about lobbying and how it works? You're curious about how it helps you as a citizen or whether it does, you can give us a call and join the conversation at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. We'd also like to hear from you lobbyists in our audience. If you're not out, if you're not out leveraging power right now, you can give us a call at 800-989-8255. Later in the program, Free Speech Out West, the Montana Sedition Project. But first, lobbying. Tom Edsel is the national political reporter for The Washington Post and joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome, Tom.
How are you?
I'm fine. Where did this term come from, lobbyist?
There's some debate about it. Some argue that its origins are English, and the word is, as it would sound, people standing out in the lobby outside Parliament trying to catch members as they go in. To leverage them. The other sort of more colorful story is that it comes from the lobby of the Hotel Willard in downtown Washington. That lobby is still there. It's quite spectacular. And during President Grant's days, lobbyists and the president and members of Congress used to all go through there, and it was a great place to, much better than being on Capitol Hill, in fact, to catch a member.
Well, whichever story you prefer, it suggests the kind of informality of catching people outside of their normal course of duties to talk with them about things that interest them or their clients.
Yes, the whole idea is to access is the ultimate, is the key ingredient. Beyond that, there's much more, but getting to someone is the first thing you got to do.
So how did the what kind of an industry, what's the track that this industry has been on? As you suggest, it's been going on. The idea of trying to influence lawmakers and power, people in power, has been going on for a long time. But now it's an industry. You've got big firms that do this. How has it grown? How quickly has it grown?
Well, what's happened, I think, is that before Watergate and before those reforms, a great deal of lobbying took place that no one knew about at all. There was very poor disclosure, if any disclosure whatsoever. It was hard to track who was behind Bill X or Amendment Y. Part of the whole Watergate reforms of that tone produced some lobbying disclosure requirements and some transparency. And what you've seen really since the mid-70s is an explosion in the lobbying community. I think it's now exceeds $2 billion a year in publicly disclosed fees, and that really does not count the huge scope of what takes place in Washington, where there are public relations agencies, advisory groups that tell strategic advisory groups. Henry Kissinger, for example, is very involved in public policy, but I do not believe that he registers as a lobbyist. There are many who fit that, but those who do register now disclose their fees for lobbying. They do not provide much information about what exactly they do or any detail on who they've contacted or what fundraisers they've held, any of that kind of detail.
Talking with Tom Edsel of the Washington Post today about lobbying and inviting your phone calls at 800-989-8255. The idea that transparency would be the solution to some of the problems of lobbying, some of the excesses that were experienced during the Watergate period. Tell us about how this debate came along and why it was transparency and not, you know, sort of prohibition that was the answer to the problem.
Well, really, lobbying is a protected constitutional activity. Trying to go to your member of Congress, I don't know the exact language from the Constitution, but petitioning your representatives, some language like that, is basically a protected right, and it would be very dangerous not to have that right, the ability to go and make your case, and even to hire someone else to do it for you. So it's very hard to regulate or prohibit the act of lobbying itself. The theory has been that transparency would be one way to make it embarrassing so that if a bill went through that was of dubious character and you could see how much money was put in behind it and who was actually influenced, that might act as kind of a healing medicine in the process.
And has it?
No. And in fact, well, the Abramoff case does not really fit this in either way because the huge chunk of money that was involved there was not disclosed at all. These were backdoor payments made by the Indian tribes to a public relations firm that Abramoff and a guy named Mike Scanlon set up. It collected millions upon millions of dollars on the side, never publicly disclosed. And technically, they did not have to be disclosed because they're public relations activities. The real argument in the prosecution of both of those men is that money really was a kickback. There was no service really provided for all that money.
And the big complaint about lobbying when it's done, even when it's done legally in this country, and we should probably understand where the money goes. These are not bribes paid to lawmakers that go into their pockets so that they can buy, you know, expensive stuff. This is money that's used by up front. It's publicly disclosed. The money's used to help them get reelected.
Well, it's a little more complex than that. Lobbyists now have expanded their role on Capitol Hill so that they play a significant part in the lives of members of Congress in terms of their elections, in terms of their fundraising. There are lobbyists who serve as treasurers of members' campaign committees and leadership committees. There are lobbyists who now really are part of the whip organizations on Capitol Hill, where when they're trying to get legislation through, they have a whole network of lobbyists who are basically signed up for the cause, not just for their own clients, and they will go and work a bill like trade legislation or whatever. There are lists of lobbyist-sponsored fundraisers, and when Congress is in session, there must be 10 or to 30 a day virtually. These are often, it'll say, so-and-so from X company would like the honor of people willing to pay $1,000 each to pay tribute to Congressman X, Y, and Z. This goes on routinely, day in, day out. It's really quite a phenomenon on Capitol Hill.
Talking about lobbying today on Talk of the Nation with my guest Tom Edsel. John is on the line from Tucson. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to make the comment that a lot of times when people are talking about lobbying, they're thinking about it in terms of elected officials, and that's, I think, probably the case with Jack Abramoff. But people often forget that lobbying goes on a lot in the executive branch agencies. It could be anything from, like, say, the chemical manufacturers lobbying the EPA or the Farm Bureau and the Department of Agriculture, and it affects the regulatory process and rulemaking and things along those lines.
All levels of government. Thank you, John. Tom Edsel?
The caller is absolutely right. Even in Jack Abramoff's case, the Indian tribes were as much concerned with decisions at the Department of Interior as they were the decisions of members of Congress. those regulatory decisions. You see them on the energy front, in mining, and all kinds of areas. And all that gets much less coverage in the newspapers than what happens up on Capitol Hill, although what is done in the regulatory process can have much more consequence.
But again, I want to be clear. The idea that people have an idea, they have a pet project, and they want to make sure that it passes so they contact whoever can help them get this done. That's what our democracy is founded on. And then there's this thing called lobbying that once we hear the word, we're a little bit, we're shocked by, you know, sort of the excesses. What is it that we're complaining about? Is it access? Or is it how the access, who has it, and what really turns the wheels?
Well, I think it's going to be an inherent problem in the American free market system. There's really nothing you can do. People who have money and companies that have money are going to be able to hire the talented, skilled people who have access to members of Congress, often as former staffers or as fundraisers and all kinds of roles, whereas the average citizen clearly cannot afford to do that. So there's always going to be an unfair distribution of power, and I think that is one of the nagging problems that underlies lobbying. But it's one that, unless you're going to alter our system of government, is not going to change very likely.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about those changes, about some of the proposed changes in lobbying legislation, some of those that we've seen in recent years, track how well they've done, take a look at the proposals to project how well they might do as we continue to talk about lobbying today on Talk of the Nation, and take your calls at 800-989-8255. You can send us an email at totn at npr.org. I'm Frank Stacio. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The guilty plea of Washington super lobbyist Jack Abramoff to charges of conspiracy and fraud have put a spotlight directly on lobbyists and their trade. Today we're talking about lobbyists and the peddling of influence and power. And if you have questions about how lobbying is done, what effect it has, whether it's necessary and how it should be reformed, give us a call at 800-989-8255. We'd also like to hear from any current or former lobbyists in our audience. Tom Edsel is with me, Washington Post national reporter. And I'd like to introduce you to Larry LaRocco, who's a senior partner at Fleischman-Hillard Government Relations, a former Democratic congressman from Idaho. And he joins us from Santa Monica, California. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you. Good day.
Scott Klug is another a lobbyist and one who is the managing director of public affairs at Foley Lardner. He's also a former Republican congressman from Wisconsin, and he joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. Scott Klug, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Larry LaRocco, let me start with you and talk a little bit about the perception of lobbyists. If I'm fair in this, I would say that folks aren't very don't have a high regard for lobbyists. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair assessment. You know, sometimes when you're active in this pursuit, you wonder why you didn't become a pharmacist or something, you know, with a better profile. But it generally has a negative connotation. But when I talk to people about that, and they might be aghast, I simply ask them what they do for a living, and whether they're a nutritionist or a lobby or a lawyer or engineer or sanitation worker or whatever, then explain that their pursuit is represented in Washington, D.C. In a $12 trillion economy, everybody's going to have some representation in Washington, D.C., watching what's going on.
Okay, Scott Klug, everybody's going to have some representation, but the argument at this moment is that those who have a lot more money have a lot more representation.
I think that's true, but only in the sense that it's a caricature. I mean, I think the fallout from the Abramoff scandal is that folks think that everybody who goes and lobbies a member of Congress only represents large corporate America. my congressional district when I was in was essentially a 60-mile radius around Madison, Wisconsin, which meant a fair amount of the folks who came to see me with lobbyists actually represented, for example, agricultural trade associations. So, you know, there would be a lobbyist who came out with Wisconsin dairy farmers. There would be a lobbyist who'd come with corn growers. There would be a lobbyist who'd come with the pork producers or the cattlemen. And so oftentimes the lobbyists are there to help those groups sort of talk in shorthand and code, which people do in the lobbying world or the radio business or as a nurse or whatever business you're involved in. And they're really there to help communicate the needs of your constituents. And I would guess in Larry's case and in my case, the vast majority of lobbyists I saw were most of the time accompanied by people from my district. Now, I was on the Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction, for example, over telecommunications issues, so I'd see people from AT&T and SBC. But I would guess at the end of the day, that's probably only 10 or 15% of the folks I would see who professionally were lobbyists, who usually were accompanied by somebody from back home.
Tom Edsel at the Washington Post, you've been watching this process for a long time. How does it actually work? Is this a question of people being sort of going up to a congressman and being persuasive? What is it that actually turns the deal and gets a congressman's attention? Is it simply persuasion?
Well, I mean, the congressman is right, ex-congressman is right in saying that excuse me, if you have local pressure, you're going to be much more effective. And if there is a local interest that is in favor or against something that the congressman faces as a choice coming up, that's going to have a lot more to do with his decision than some abstract company from New York or whatever without any district interest. One of the skills of lobbyists has been to mobilize, it's called grassroots lobbying, to mobilize local people for causes of all kinds, and to develop their stockholders as lobbyists, to develop local branch managers and so forth. And lobbyists know very well that it's very important to have local ties to be able to get good access to a member.
Let's go to the phones. Russ is on the line from Rochester, Minnesota. Hello, Russ.
I have a question about some of the scandals going on. Some of these involve lobbyists writing legislation, which are submitted by friendly congressmen. The classic image is things going on in a smoke-filled room, and we're all told not to watch too closely how our laws are made. If we like them the same as don't watch how sausage is made, if you like to eat it. But in the software industry, we trace every line that's written or changed to its author. And since sunshine is the best disinfectant, why don't we do this with our laws so that congressmen or staffers can't do this under the table and at least have to own up to where things came from?
The this you're referring to actually writing when lobbyists write the legislation. Why do we disclose that someone else other than the congressman or staff wrote the
legislation? Why don't we just disclose where everything came from? So if, say, a senator is getting a lot of money from Disney and they're writing a number of things very friendly to Disney, we know exactly whose staffer that came from in the committee.
All right. Well, let's get a response to that.
Hi, this is Scott Kluge.
Scott, yeah.
You do that. I mean, all of that stuff, there's a very clear paper trail. And every amendment that's submitted to a committee, for example, for a markup on a bill has to come from a member of Congress. It's got to be sponsored by somebody. And so I disagree with the supposition of the caller that somehow this is all very mysterious. Now, do lobbyists suggest to members of Congress changes in wordings in legislation? Absolutely. But I want to go back to my first point. I mean, given the choice between some corporation that drops into my office unannounced, who I have no relationship with, who, you know, theoretically and sort of the way this has been colored, is going to raise a lot of campaign money for me, or my constituents back home, at the end of the day, most members of Congress want to get reelected. And the way to get reelected is to make your constituents back home happy. And so, again, I think I want to disabuse folks of this notion that somehow there's this sort of vast array of disembodied lobbyists who show up in members' office that don't have any connections to them. Most of it, even the campaign money, the grassroots organization, at the end of the day is to focus to get people reelected. And the way you usually get reelected is by keeping people back home very happy.
This is Larry, too. I would add that a lot of this starts with concepts, and if the member of Congress agrees with the concept and where something is going from a constituent back home, then they take that to the Legislative Council and they put it in legislative language. And so you take it from the grassroots all the way up through the process. And It's not necessarily drafted. There is a symbiotic relationship, however, that can't be denied between the lobbying community. But many of the people who are lobbyists are working away on very intricate, detailed issues that are putting a comma here or doing something that is all making the wheels of government work, because in a complicated society and with many changes, a $12 trillion economy, there are going to be needed amendments, and they come from various sources. And the vehicle for getting those into the legislative process is obviously the member of Congress. And there's actually more sunshine on this than people would believe.
Well, let's talk about some of the changes that have already taken place in terms of lobbying. In 1995, Congress passed a Lobbying Disclosure Act. Tom Etzel, what did that do?
It made it so that they had to disclose much more of the actual dollar amount you were spending. Before then, lobbyists were reporting tiny, tiny sums for what amounted to really major efforts. And now there is much better reporting in terms of the costs spent by groups ranging from the Chamber of Commerce to lobbying firms like the one that disclosed in the scandal, Alexander Strategy Group.
So there's a lot of information available, and
well,
a voter
can
figure some information available.
I would simply add that Tom made a really good point earlier in the program that a lot of the pressure on members of Congress goes back to their constituencies. In other words, if there's if something is asymmetrical in terms of where their contributions and support is coming from, then the constituents back home are going to notice that. One of the problems that we have right now are all these safe seats where you almost have to be a serial killer to lose your seat. If you don't have a safe seat and it's marginal, then you're paying attention all the time to what you need to do back home and what attention you're paying to your constituency and how they would feel through this transparent system of knowing that you were getting so much money from Wall Street or the telecommunications companies or Disney, as your listener mentioned, that the final arbiter on this has been the constituents. But we seem to have gotten away from that because of the safe seat notion.
Well, Tom Etzel, how much time would constituents have to put in sort of sorting out where the money's come from and how that may or may not have paid off for them in terms of what their congresspeople are doing? I mean, it sounds like it would take an awful lot of time on the part of a voter to figure out where the money's coming from and whether it worked.
All I can tell you is that the press in Idaho were pretty attuned to following that because it was so disclosed and transparent.
Well, Tom Etzel, I know that you I'll give you time to answer that if you wanted to chime in.
I think that the press in Idaho may, and there are some good papers in Idaho, but in most districts there is virtually no attention paid to this by the press, and it really is the obligation of newspapers to ask citizens to do this kind of work. It's just a huge burden, but it is sort of basic news coverage. Most local papers do not have anyone in Washington, and they don't. And figuring out how to track all this stuff, it's a lot of hard work. And the lobbying is particularly hard because it's not with the campaign money you can track that and who gave it. But with the lobbying, it's very hard to see how, because they do not disclose who they've talked to or who they've taken out to dinner or any of that kind of thing.
Well, that said, would you say then that more disclosure is likely to make this a cleaner process?
I think it's. I am a big proponent of disclosure, in part because that's my business is writing about this, and the more that I can know, the better. I have mixed feelings about the sort of the cleansing nature of disclosure. We've had more and more disclosure, and I think basically what you've done to some extent is institutionalize and legalize a process that is pretty sleazy sometimes.
Well, Larry LaRocco, do you think the system, let me ask you about that.
Sure.
I think he just called you a name.
I'm talking about.
I know the industry. I know. Does the system need reforming?
I think it does. I mean, there is a danger in going overboard and going too far on it, but I think we can really clean this up a little bit. For example, I know a lot of companies in D.C. or entities with PACs, for example, that are sick and tired of the insatiable appetite by leadership PACs. And that's just another way to have a bite at the contribution apple. You give $10,000 one year, and then people demand $20,000 the next year. And I think maybe we need a timeout on that. I don't know if Tom wrote the story, but the Post wrote a great story, I thought, on Tom DeLay and how he used one of his campaign committees to really live a pretty lavish lifestyle. And the folks back in Houston and Sugar Land really didn't intend for him to do that and to raise the money and then to go off to Caribbean islands and put everything under the rubric of campaign activities. And that's not what members of Congress should be doing. So there's room for reform here.
Larry, I know that you have to go, and Tom Edsel as well, so I want to thank you both. Larry LaRocco is a senior partner at Fleischman Hillard Government Relations. So Larry, thank you.
Thank you for having me on the program.
And Tom Edsel of The Washington Post, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure being with you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about lobbying, what can be done and what should be done to reform it. My guest is Scott Klug. He's Managing Director of Public Affairs for Foley and Lardner. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Well, not all lobbying work involves big bucks and flashy perks. Nonprofit organizations like churches also employ lobbyists, and they have to use different strategies than the bigger firms. So we'll take a look at the nonprofit world right now with Sister Simone Campbell, National Coordinator of NETWRC, a Catholic social justice lobby. Sister Simone in Studio 3A, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
How has the Jack Abramoff scandal affected you and nonprofit lobbyists?
I don't believe it's really affected us too directly. At first, we got a little nervous about what sort of further reforms and further distancing between our work and the actual members of Congress would be created. But in fact, since we don't have money to give away and we don't have PACs, all we have are our people around the country and our effort at being a voice with and for those who live at the economic margins of our society. Since that's all we have, I doubt that they'll outlaw that in the near future.
So you're not too worried about any of the reforms. Is the work that you do fundamentally different from the work of the sort of K Street lobbying firms in terms of how you try to pressure lawmakers to get change?
There are many similarities, but the fact is we don't have money, so what we need is people. And what we've established at NETWRC, for instance, is a broad-based membership across the country of folks who share our perspective and commitment and are engaged at the local level with their legislators. The points that were made earlier about having members from a district or members from a state engage their representatives is the key piece. And that's what we work with, both through e-advocacy. The Internet's a great invention for us, and also through our one-on-one relationships on the Hill with legislators.
Does it work?
Does it work? It has worked in some settings. I believe, for instance, the current budget situation in the House, where they have not yet passed the 2006 budget. A lot of our work has been in explaining some of the details that will adversely impact low-income folks in our country, and some of the things that were slipped in either intentionally or inadvertently, so that we've been working a lot with members' offices and with staffs to just say what's in there, and we feel like we've made a significant impact in both delaying it and in clarifying and changing some of the provisions.
Well, I want to get this straight. Is it a question of you sort of persuading a lawmaker that this legislation is right or not right, or in persuading the lawmaker that if they vote a certain way, they can count on a certain effect in the polls?
We can't draw the direct correlation between you vote for this, we'll vote for you. We can't do that one-on-one. I think the message, if constituents are reporting, are engaging them, then that message is very clear. Our message usually is trying to touch their hearts, but because of the things that we come at from a faith and values perspective, and to touch the legislator's heart to see what do they care about and how do they meet that. And the second point is to just explain what's in these laws, because the point was made that this is often are very complex areas, and moving a comma, inserting a phrase can make dramatic radically different results. And so our effort is both for clarity and for compassion.
I'm talking with Sister Simone Campbell of NETWRC, a national coordinator of a program, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby. Scott Klug is also with me, Managing Director of Public Affairs for Foley & Lardner. What we're talking about today is lobbying. We'll wrap up that discussion and then talk about a number of people who were jailed for sedition in Montana in the early 20th century. It's all part of the program. That's coming your way in just a moment, so stay with us. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our discussion on lobbying. Our guest is Sister Simone Campbell, a Catholic nun and national coordinator of NETWRC, a National Catholic Social Lobby Group. Scott Klug is with us as well, Managing Director of Public Affairs for Foley and Lardner. And we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. So, Scott, before the break, you heard Sister Simone talk about what you do when you don't have much money. How is it different for firms like yours, which do have money?
Well, you know, this is all about developing relationships, and I think lobbyists, whether they represent nonprofits or represent corporations, want to build relationships with members so they can get access to them. I got a call the other day asking if I'd be on Jim Lehrer's NewsHour talking about the lobbying scandal, and the call came from a guy named Jim Trengrove, who I used to work with in television in Washington. Would I have taken the call? Absolutely. Would have I taken it? Did I take it faster because it came from Jim? You bet. And so that relationship, whether it's in healthcare, the grocery store business, you know, small town lumber yards, relationships matter every place else. And I think that's really what drives lobbyists to try to get to know members of Congress. Not that the member of Congress will change their mind, but so you have a personal relationship so you can try to do a better job selling it.
Let's go ahead.
I'm sorry, you asked about reforms earlier,
yeah.
Mike. If I could just say one thing that I think would make a major difference is Congress is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act, which is a federal law that essentially allows journalists, like your guest who is from the Washington Post, to write, for example, and ask for records from the Defense Department or records from the Secretary of State office or even from the President's office. And there are some very specific exemptions for national security. You couldn't write and ask for a list of CIA agents. But you can get a hold of a lot of things in the executive branch, including schedules for people. And it seems to me that if members of Congress had to disclose their meetings records to journalists, and if members of Congress had to disclose the phone calls, for example, made and received at their office, it would sort of change things. They'd have to underwrite, exist in a rubric where there's more disclosure. And so back to your disclosure question earlier, I think if members of Congress had to make some of their personal records, business done in their office, more available to the press, I think that would clean up a lot of things in a hurry.
Let's go out to Haverford, Pennsylvania. Chuck is on the line. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My call is in regards to the fact that my uncle, Bill Natcher, served for 40-something years as a congressman and ended up being chairman of the Appropriations Committee prior to the time that he passed away during the Clinton years. And interestingly enough, when he did not deal very well with lobbyists, as a matter of fact, he pretty well steered clear of them. And the fascinating thing is that when his wife passed away 3 or 4 years before he did, as chairman of Appropriations, he received thousands of bouquets of flowers from lobbyists all over the country. And it wasn't the flowers. It was the thousands upon thousands of dollars of cut glass vases and sterling silver pieces and everything that came with it, to the point that after her funeral, they had down in Kentucky they had a sale of all of those things, and it brought in thousands of dollars for a food cupboard. He died as chairman of the Appropriations Committee in 1994. When his funeral took place, there was a wreath from the president, a wreath from the House of Representatives, and a wreath from the Senate. Half of the congressional body was there. The president spoke at his funeral along with Tip O'Neill. But what is really interesting is that not a single flower came, to the point that the family chipped in and bought flowers to make the church even just look like he was there. And the reason is, he didn't have the power anymore. I think it's interesting to me that you're bringing up this whole point, but it comes down to congressmen having to also police themselves. And for 40-something years, he just didn't take money. Now, that's a very hard thing to do if you're not from a rural community as he was. But in the long run, if you don't take the money, they can't have you in their pocket.
All right. Well, Chuck, let's get. I want to have time to get a response, but I do appreciate the story. Thank you very much, Scott Klug. On the one hand, if you don't take the money, then they don't have you in your pocket. There is a kind of an equation there, but also, given the expense of campaigns these days, can you afford to turn the money away?
And let me talk about that second. Let me address more head on this question. I don't really think that's different, frankly, from anybody who's retired in any business. I mean, I suspect if the CEO of ExxonMobil drops dead this afternoon, his church is going to be filled with thousands of flowers that come from folks who do business with ExxonMobil, or the head of CBS Television, whatever the case might be. 15 years later, when they're retired, is it going to be filled up with gifts from and memorials from vendors and business relationships? No. So I don't necessarily think that story as told illustrates what the caller had to say. But let me talk about relationships with fundraising. Again, I think that every member of Congress wants to get reelected. It's easier to get reelected if you have money than if you don't have money, but that's just sort of simple arithmetic. But I think Sister, who's on the sitting in the studio with you, can tell you the story that at the end of the day, what still matters more than anything else are relationships with constituents and how your voters feel about you. And back to Larry LaRocco's point earlier on, if you do something that's out of perspective, voters understand that. I mean, if you're flying around on corporate jets, which is one of the allegations of the Abramoff case, where you only pay the cost of a one-way business ticket, you don't pay the cost of the two corporate jet. I mean, if I'm flying from here to San Francisco, it's not $1,000. It's $20,000 or $30,000. I think that's an abuse that should be stopped. And one of the things I've thought has been long ripe for abuse is the role of spouses, where spouses get hired by foundations or get hired by assignment, which is a direct payment to the member of Congress, not necessarily the same kind of thing as a campaign contribution. So there's more disclosure than ever before. If you're a crook, you're going to be a crook no matter how much disclosure it is. And unfortunately, that's the lesson I think we've learned over the last 6 months. After the reforms that came from Abscam in the 80s, after the reforms that came from the House Bank fallout in the 1990s, whatever changes Congress will make this time out, if your intention's to be a crook, you're going to be a crook.
Well, Sister Simone, I saw you nod when Scott talked about relationship being an important thing. I wonder if grassroots organizing is really the strength of a nonprofit lobby organization. If you've seen any growth in that as a result of these scandals, a sense that if we don't have the money, we do have the people power and we can affect things that way, or are people becoming discouraged and dropping out of the process? What do you see?
I actually see both, but I see a great increase in interest in our work. And I think one of the pieces that fuels that is the convenience of the Internet in terms of communication makes it so much simpler to communicate. But the other piece is that I think that there's a growing disenchantment with the idea that government is also part of a free market system and that government can be bought. And that's some of the equation that gets set up in these cases. You've got money. It only can go to the highest bidder if it's a commodity to be bought like in the rest of the market. The fact is government is to do the things that we cannot do alone by ourselves. And so that coming together is the critical piece, and people are beginning to realize that.
Sister Simone Campbell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
National Coordinator of Network, a National Catholic Social Justice Lobby. Scott Klug, thank you.
Thank you.
Managing Director of Public Affairs for Foley and Lardner. Coming up, we'll take a look at the Sedition Act in Montana. It's been repealed, but oh, what havoc it caused when it was in place. Stay with us.